You're listening to New Retirement Radio, brought to you by the team at Prout Financial Design.
Hello, I'm your host, Certified Financial Planner Dennis Prout.
I'm Heidi Cartwright, Financial Advisor and RICP.
Advisors associated with Prout Financial Design may be either 1. Registered representatives with and securities offered through LPL Financial, member FINRA SIPC, and investment advisor representatives of Integrated Partners, a registered investment advisor, or 2. Solely investment advisor representatives of Integrated Partners, a registered investment advisor, and not affiliated with LPL Financial. Investment advice offered through Integrated Partners, a registered investment advisor. Integrated Partners and Prout Financial Design are separate entities from LPL Financial. Dennis Prout and Nathan Prout are solely investment advisor representatives of Integrated Partners and are not affiliated with LPL Financial. The opinions voiced in this show program are for general information only and are not intended to provide specific advice or recommendations for any individual. To determine which strategies or investments may be suitable for you, consult the appropriately qualified professional before making a decision.
WTCM News Talk 580. Welcome aboard. It's Prout Financial Design's New Retirement Radio every Thursday at 10 o'clock, starring Mr. Dennis Prout. Good morning, sir.
Good morning. Good morning, Ron.
Good morning, sir.
Thursday, March 13th, 2025. Welcome to each and every listener. Thank you for listening. Man, it's good to be here. Missed last week, but good to be back in the saddle. And we have lots to talk about. But first, Heidi Cartwright joins us, our own RICP and Managing Director. Good morning, Heidi.
Good morning. I'm delighted to be here this morning. We should have a great conversation this morning.
I think so, too. Now, we're all sitting in different spaces this morning, in case you hadn't noticed. So just so you know, we're all sitting a bit differently because we have our guest with us, the one and only Courtney Danbrook, local estate planning attorney. Welcome, Courtney, as well.
Good morning. Thank you for having me.
It's great to have you here. Now, Courtney represents individuals, families, and businesses in the areas of estate and wealth succession planning, family cottage preservation, and legacy asset planning. She also counsels banks, trust companies, and individual fiduciaries in all aspects of trust and probate administration and litigation matters. Courtney's thoughtful and thorough approach puts clients at ease, ensuring their interest and their intent is protected. Couldn't agree more. I wonder who wrote that.
I don't know, but you made me sound really important.
Courtney has also served on the board of the Grand Traverse Regional Land Conservancy. What a great group that is. Vice chair and secretary.
Correct.
And the Impact 100 Global Advisory Council secretary, and currently serves on the board of the Children's House and Traverse Connect. Courtney is a member of the State Bar of Michigan, the State Bar of Montana, Grand Traverse Leelanau Interim Bar Association, Women's Lawyers Association, and is SCAO, Trained General Civil Mediator. What is that, SCAO?
You know, in it my next life, important. When I want to become a mediator, I could do that. I have that certification. But I actually use that skill every day with my clients, certainly.
Awesome. Michigan State University College of Law, JD with honors, and also the MSU Eli Broads College of Business, BA with honors. So awesome.
They give that out to everybody. Don't
stop it. In her spare time, Courtney can be found outside or on the Great Lakes enjoying the unspoiled beauty of northern Michigan with her husband, Chris, their two sons, and my favorite part of this, their black lab Kubota.
Kubota.
What a great name for a dog, right?
Right.
You got it.
As only your sons could do.
That's right. Yep. When you leave it up to two boys, that's what you
that's what you end up.
The female dog gets married or gets named after a tractor.
Yes. Hey, before you get into any questions for Courtney,
we
have a text. Can you do a brief overview of the difference between an ETF and what is that, and a mutual fund?
An ETF stands for an exchange traded fund. They tend to be more specialized. But they may not. They may be generally managed as a mutual fund. But they allow that specialization because they're immediately, as a part of them being immediately tradable during the day. So they can be very similar to a mutual fund. It might own 50 different companies or stocks within that portfolio, as does the mutual fund. But the mutual fund is priced at the end of each day. Why would that make a difference? Well, because you can buy and sell that ETF throughout the day, and it's repriced according to the market's valuation of that portfolio. Just like that. Can you hear me snapping my fingers? How about me? There we go. That works better.
Our ETFs,
that quick.
Are they in some retirement plans? Are they in 401s or IRAs?
Yeah, we use ETFs in our portfolio. Now, the other difference is that ETFs tend to be more cost efficient and effective. Now, where a mutual fund, for instance, as an example, might charge 0.75% for its management fees on an ongoing basis. A bit more expensive, actively managed fund, say. And ETF's fees might be anywhere from 0.1% to 0.4%. So, in general, about half the management fee of a regular mutual fund. In that case, that can serve to your interest. Now, what's interesting, too, is several major mutual fund companies have come out with their own ETFs. And we are utilizing those en masse, if you will, within our portfolios to save those same fees and expose clients to the same types of portfolios that they could get through a mutual fund. So is that a good synopsis?
I would say you covered most of the
major points
there.
Now that everyone's not asleep yet. Is it really 10:16 already? Oh, my gosh. So, Courtney, let's head into the estate planning right away, shall we? From the 50,000-foot view first, if you would, generally, in estate planning, what or who tends to be most successful at navigating the issues you see today to be the most common place, if you will, to solve those issues and to get through the issues that they see as they age or encounter life? Who tends to be most successful? What are their attitudes? What do you see that they do?
Yeah, and I think you said it well, looking at it from the 50,000-foot perspective, those that are going to be successful at navigating through that certainly are those that plan ahead, you know, before it's too late. And, you know, we did have some discussions as far as what is on top of people's minds when they talk about aging and the process of aging, because that goes hand in hand with estate planning in general. That makes people really start thinking about, do I have my plan in place? What, you know, how am I going to make this easy on those that I leave behind? So I would say, you know, being a planner, being organized, and being willing to confront that, and that's why people avoid it. You know, they don't want to confront our own mortality, so it's easier to avoid it. But that doesn't necessarily equate to good consequences after that.
Confronting money and death, would that be one way to say it?
Yeah, absolutely.
Confronting it, actually saying, "I'm going to get this done." So it's an attitude. Is that what you would say?
Oh yes, for sure. So, attitude and action.
Action. Okay. So I know, in essence, this needs to be done. This is an issue, or I know it's going to be a problem if I don't deal with it. I'm just going to make that phone call. Now, would a part of that be willing to say I'm willing to pay a fee as well?
Yeah, I think just like anything that we do, we know as individuals we don't have the skills in every area of life. And so also that attitude to be able to open up and say, yeah, I do need help, and I need to find the right person to help me get through this process.
So if someone comes to you with their questions, situation generally, is that a fair question of them to ask, because I brought it up, you know, what approximately will be the fee for getting this work done?
Yeah, and my practice is obviously, you know, once you get to know me, you know that I am one that treats everyone absolutely differently, because we are. Our families are different, our assets are different, our situations are different. And so I can't speak for others, but my practice always is, I don't know what the scope of the work is even going to look like until I'm able to meet with you and find out about your family, find out about your asset situation, find out what is your intent. And so once I find that out, then absolutely I'd be able to put an estimate together to say, here's what we're actually doing and here's what it would cost.
Okay. You didn't say, and I know that that wasn't all-encompassing, but do you see any difference between those who communicate this with their children and those who don't, for those who do have children? Or loved ones. We'll just put it that way.
Yeah. Yeah. And you're right. The one of the probably most motivating factors for people is certainly, I don't want to leave a burden on my family, whether that's children, family members, friends, whoever's going to be left behind to deal with this. That is the motivating factor. And they are always approaching estate planning, looking at me saying, how I just want to make this easy for those that I leave behind. And that circles right back to what we said in the beginning, planning. You got to plan.
Are there some situations where clients have, you mentioned the word easy, what if they have difficult assets to settle? You know, how do you walk them through that? Let's say they've got a piece of property that they own with a gentleman and his brother. They're joint tenants, you know? Nothing's ever going to happen to either one of them. They've owned that piece of property for 50 years together. How do you walk somebody through that situation in terms of settling it? And let's say the sons, in this case it's two boys, don't really want to hold that piece of property with their uncle, even though they love their uncle. They may not want to hold that. How do you walk somebody through that sort of situation?
Yeah, and you're absolutely right. You know, I have clients who come in with certainly ideas of what they think their family or their children or what they want. And part of that process and part of what my job is to kind of walk them through reality too. You know, sure, this is what you want to happen, but is this truly what, you know, your children want? And if we don't know yet, that's okay, because right now we're planning for a snapshot in time, and this plan may not come into play for another 30 years. So then let's build in flexibility so that we don't tie hands of children, we don't tie hands of family members to just say, here you go, here's five kids, and you're all going to own this property together. Good luck, you know?
Yeah. So one's in California, one's in Oregon, one's in Massachusetts or whatever. They have no intent of hanging onto that property, even though the parent may not necessarily know that. Now, as you said that, I was thinking, you asked me point blank, you said, in our own situation, are you sure Nathan's siblings are okay with him buying the business from you when you're dead, Dennis? You didn't say it quite that way. And I said, yes, I've spoken to them. And I was relieved that I had. But I thought it was a great question. So you're trying to get the full view of the family and where they might be. Now, have you ever, here's a question out of left field, ever talked to the other siblings to find out where they're at? Or have you ever had those kind of conversations with family and been able to be that in that part of the situation?
Sure. And that's always, you know, you have to be careful, because obviously my client is parent. And so I would never be able to speak to children or anybody else about what their plan is unless they expressly allow me to do that. To
sure.
answer
so,
your
question,
if I may,
so you yeah. get approval or authorization
yes.
from them. First.
Yes, and okay. there has been where they have asked me on certain topics. I want to get my kids together, and I want you, because you can explain it. I want you to be the one to communicate with them and see what the feedback is at this point.
Wow, are the parents often surprised in those situations?
I think sometimes they are, because okay. I think in their mind, they may have what they think their children want, but they haven't had that difficult conversation with them, and or children may not feel comfortable saying, no, that's not really what, I know that's your idea or your goal, but that's not mine.
So in some cases, the children can feel pressured because they want to please mom and dad.
Exactly. Yep. Family
yeah.
dynamics.
Maybe that changes when the parent, if the parent passes away or the parents pass away, and then this person has a different viewpoint. And having, I think the key of what I heard you saying, having the flexibility within the document to address something different happening and being able to address it without further complications.
Absolutely. Yeah. Yeah. Yep. And you do. You have children that's their parent. And so they aren't going to want to, so to speak, buck the system. They're going to want to go along with that. And so that's, again, the importance of the document to say, great, we don't know, in fact, what that individual will want until the time comes, which will happen in the future sometime.
You bet. What health or aging-related issues do you see now where these documents are critical to helping people get through those situations? So what health or aging-related issues do you see now, these days, if you will?
Yeah, I would say when I have clients in, again, when we think about what our discussions are generally, a lot of people are thinking about cognitive impairment, you know, and, you know, when we have issues of cognitive decline, what if that happens to me? I've seen it with family members. How am I going to make sure I prepare for that? Caregiving and paying for care and caring for others, those are really, you know, on people's minds and looking at what can we do to make sure the best that we can prepare for those situations.
So whether it's dementia, whether it's some other cognitive decline, one spouse is fine, the other one's not. How do we get through this? What are the documents that are used generally, if you will, in those situations?
Yeah, and I always refer to them as my lifetime documents, and those are powers of attorney, and they are absolutely critical, you know, because one is financial power of attorney, because we're going to be able to appoint who we want to put in our shoes to be able to walk around and deal with third parties, anything business or financial related. And similarly, healthcare power of attorney, which will include things that people hear all the time, a medical directive or a living will, that includes all of that. Not only do we get to appoint who our what we call patient advocate is to be the one to make medical decisions for us, but we can express our more specific wishes as far as what do we want for life-sustaining treatment, heroic measures, all of those things too.
Tell us what a power of attorney is, if you will.
Exactly. I mean, the best way I can describe it in both of those instances is, again, a legal document that a third party who I've appointed can take, and I should say an individual, can take to a third party and present that document and be able to stand before that third party and either do healthcare-related decisions or financial or business as if I was standing before that third party.
And I know I had a recent example we talked about on Monday of how important what the wording is and the powers that you give that person are stated in the document. I had someone who had a power of attorney and wanted to sign in the place of the person who could no longer function as the trustee for the trust. And I was asking you, is that like a thing? Can we do that? And yeah, you said you can.
Yeah, and that comes up a lot. You know, again, it's important to make that distinction between financial power of attorney and what that position is and who your agent is under that versus a trustee or a successor trustee. Two totally different positions, two different hats that somebody is wearing, and two different legal documents that control what are the powers and authority of those people in those positions under those two. And without express powers, allowing a power of attorney to act in the place of the person that was successor trustee, usually that's a no, that is not. It's not typical that those two would be interchangeable. Instead, the trust is going to say, successor trustee, if you're not able anymore, then here's the person or persons that's going to step into your position.
Right. So it can get complicated quite quickly if you're trying to get something done and you don't have these documents set up properly.
So, Courtney, thank you again for joining us. Courtney Danbrook, how would someone contact you at your office? What's your phone number, if you would?
Sure. 231-714-0157 is our main number.
714-0157.
Correct.
231 area code. And what's your email or what's your website?
Sure. So, www.darlawyersplural.com. We're located right on the corner of Division and 2nd Street at 625 2nd Street. And email address obviously can be found on the website. Mine specifically, cdanbrook@darlawyers, again, plural.com.
Darlawyers.com. Awesome. Thank you. So if someone's scrambling to catch up, they wish that they would have done this sort of planning beforehand, but parts of it got done, parts of it didn't. What do they need to do first? Let's say the powers of attorney are out of date. The financial companies won't accept them. How do you handle those kinds of situations?
Yeah, I mean, again, it's whether you have nothing or something that is 30 years old, it's that action step. Just, you know, you've got to do something. If you don't do anything, it's not going to get any better. So taking that step to whether it's contact your attorney, whether it's, I always say, even if you get online and you fill out a form, that's at least something.
Okay. So continue moving that ball forward, whether you do need to decide you need to contact your attorney or not. And then what forms or documents are most helpful for the basics? Is it the powers of attorney first?
Yeah, I mean, usually, no matter what, yes, we're going to have healthcare power of attorney. We're going to have financial power of attorney. Keep in mind, those, again, are what we call the lifetime documents, because those are only valid during lifetime. And people get caught up in that, where they try to present a financial power of attorney after someone passes. It's no longer valid. And so at a minimum, powers of attorney, and then at a minimum, a will. And then you talk about, do we need a trust? Do we need those sorts of things? But that is a minimum, because the will is going to appoint who you want in charge to administer your estate, and it'll direct how you want your estate administered after that, after you're gone.
Now, let's say you've determined with a client that they need a trust for whatever reason, their assets outside of the state, they don't want to subject to probate. Or they're all the way up to estate issues of taxability, if you will. What are the most common types of trusts that you see people will want to employ for themselves?
Yeah, the number one most common that you will hear is what we call a revocable grantor living trust. And that's really just a fancy word for saying, the grantor being me, I'm going to set up a trust for myself. That's my trust. It's living because it exists during my lifetime. It's for my benefit, and it's revocable at any time. As long as I'm competent and I'm alive, I can change it. I can take assets out, put assets in, do whatever I want with it.
You can change your mind.
You can change your mind. And sometimes, you know, that's what scares people, because they hear about irrevocable trusts. Well, yeah, those are certain types of trusts that we use in certain circumstances, and those are one that, yes, you do give up the ability to change, but the most common type is that revocable living trust. And it's not irrevocable, where I can't change it until I'm not competent. I shouldn't be changing it then. And when I'm gone, then it becomes irrevocable, because we don't want anybody else changing our wishes.
Okay. So it's a way to, in essence, control how the assets are dispersed after you pass away.
And during your lifetime. That's why we call it that living trust. So if I'm incapacitated, but my assets are in my trust, there's going to be specific provisions in that type of trust that say, yes, successor trustee, you're acting now because I can't, I'm not competent, but you're directed to use those assets for my benefit. So pay for my care, keep me sustained, however accustomed I was to the standard of living. And then you're right, Dennis, then upon my death, then it directs, okay, now that I'm gone, here's the beneficiaries that I want to receive anything that's left over at that point in time.
Who tends to be the most successful successor trustee? Let's say dad had this trust written. Let's say spouses. So he was the trustee. Let's say his wife is successor trustee. What's the second successor trustee? How does that work? Let's say they both passed away at the same time. How does that work?
Yeah, and that decision of who we put as a successor trustee, you know, that conversation goes along with who we put in our financial power of attorney, who we put in our healthcare power of attorney. And I always say, you have to match the skill of what's being asked of that person with the individual. So I always use the example, my sister's a PA. So with my own parents, you know, I always said, you absolutely put her as a healthcare power of attorney. Mm-hmm. I can speak legal, but I can't speak medical. And that is a certain skill set and a valuable one. And so positions like the successor trustee, even if we have two spouses and one spouse goes, if we know that that second spouse is just not comfortable with financial matters, we may put them with a co-trustee. And whether that's a child, whether that's a family friend, again, somebody who we know can support and carry out that position well.
Yeah, because the trustee has a lot of responsibility on their shoulders to execute what's in the trust document. And I know that Dennis and I, in meetings, we see a lot of our clients who are maybe the trustees of their parents' trust. And it's a lot of work, and there's a lot of responsibility. And maybe you could talk about what we had discussed before the show about getting that team around. The trustee should really have their own team to help them, right?
Yeah. Yeah. And no matter who you pick, and if they have a great skill set as far as a financial acumen, you know, it still is. It's a lot of work, and they're not going to know everything. If they've never served in that role, how would we expect that they know that the law, what laws apply to them, what notices they have to do, what accountings they have to do? So it is really, really important that whenever we have an individual who's not in the business of administering trusts, that they do get that team around them right away to help them. And that team, obviously, being they can hire an attorney, they can hire, you know, their financial advisor, they can bring in the CPA or the accountant, and that is sort of that trifecta of a team to have around that person to support them and make sure whatever decisions they're making, you know, those have consequences. And as you talked about IRAs in the beginning, those are one of them. How do I even deal with a distribution of an IRA in within, you know, this estate? So having that team around you is extremely important when you're...
What do you think about the parents introducing their professional team, if you will, to their children? Have you ever seen that?
Yes. Yep, absolutely. And even just from my perspective as the drafting attorney on documents, my clients, that's a relationship, right? And when we talk about families and money, it's important of who those professionals are and your relationship with those professionals. So it's not uncommon that I have clients who want me to meet the kids because they want the kids to know who they potentially could be dealing with.
Right.
And the same thing, they, whether it's just a list of all those team members, those professionals, or if it is an introduction. And I think, you know, generations ago, more closed vest, right? We didn't want to talk about finances, didn't want to talk about families, didn't want to. Now, more and more, I do see that door opening where they figure out it does make sense on some level to make sure kids have that transparency of who they need to contact, et cetera.
Excellent. Thank you, Courtney. We have a question, Ron.
We do. John in Traverse City is on the line. Good morning, John.
Good morning. Good morning. Yeah, I have a 401k, 403b. I'm 78 years old. The company that I worked for was just bought out. So now I have to take an RMD, which I don't want to do. So I would rather convert or a direct rollover to a Roth IRA.
Okay, John. Thank you for calling. So are all these funds in a Roth 401k?
No, they're not.
Okay, so if you distribute those all to a Roth IRA, it's all going to be taxable when you distribute it. Were you aware
exactly.
of that?
Yep. Yes, I am.
Okay.
And I do believe that you can, I think there's an automatic 20% on federal.
Well, yeah, you've got a lot of different rules and regs going on here, and I'm rather uncomfortable answering this question on the radio. And here's why, John, because you don't have to take it direct to yourself and pay the 20% penalty, if you will. You can roll those direct to an IRA and not pay any tax at all, and then convert whatever portion you want to on a Roth to your Roth on a continuing basis. So you also mentioned RMDs. Are you no longer working for this firm then, where you were working for them before?
Exactly.
Okay.
Yep.
So, yes, you're correct. You have to take an RMD then. Now, is this in 2025 that you are no longer employed?
Right.
Yeah, so you will have to take an RMD this year. You'll have to take that RMD before you get it distributed to your IRA. So they'll distribute that for you first. By law, they need to do that. But I would suggest you really take a look at the IRA rules and regs first. Look at what your options are so there's not a 20% automatic withholding that has to occur. Consider IRAs to distribute that to. And then the succeeding Roth conversions as you would like to pay the tax, okay?
So you can convert over a number of years and then sort of manage that tax liability that you're incurring by the conversion.
Based on your tax bracket rate, okay?
I see. Yeah, I wasn't aware that I had to take an RMD, though.
Yeah, you have to take that RMD first before you have it distributed, and they'll figure that exactly for you. And that'll be based on your 12/31/24 value of your 401k. All right?
Okay.
If you want to discuss this more fully with a financial advisor, we're happy to have that conversation with you. Our phone number 847-392 or proutfinancialdesign.com.
All right, yeah, John? That seems like my best avenue.
Appreciate the call, John.
All right, thank you so much. Appreciate
it. All righty. Okay, goodbye. Thank you. Now, isn't that a fascinating question? Because seriously, there are three or four major issues, and the reason I'm uncomfortable answering those on the radio is because I guarantee you when I listen to, which I may listen to this on Saturday, that is the rebroadcast day at 9 o'clock, I'm going to say out loud, you know, I missed one or two points in that. So these kind of conversations, generally, you want to have with an advisor, a professional person face-to-face, as in the estate planning. Having these conversations on the phone, you know, it's okay talking about basics, but Courtney's nodding. You want to have these conversations with the person so you can get the interaction and see what you know. I might sense something that Courtney's uncomfortable with, and she may move right on by that, and I may go back, okay, what else am I missing in this? That's where you get the real value, and sitting with someone.
And that's really important because a lot of actions that you do are undoable, meaning once you've done them, you've done them, and you have to deal with the consequence. So you always want to look before you leap.
We've seen that in new clients coming in that have made these decisions, rather, and paid that full 20% up front. And that tax is can be significant. Exponentially higher than it needs to be when you take a lump sum, because all that money then is included in the successive brackets as they increase with your income in that particular year. Happy talk. So the two biggest questions a trustee must know the answer to. By the way, we're stealing from Ed Slott's module here. 15 questions that a trustee of an IRA must know the answers to. And I think it's fantastic. I think a part of this, too, can be generalized in terms of what a trustee should know. But a couple of points, and I would love you to comment on these here, Courtney. Often the trustee is a family member who's not familiar with the following issues. If that is the case, does the trustee know his or her fiduciary obligations and who to call for guidance?
And that goes back to surrounding yourself with the right professionals, because that's true. It, like we said, an individual has no idea what they're doing and what laws apply to them. So,
in my view, what often happens is the parents tend to discount what they've learned over the years as they've acclimated themselves to their new situations. We bought this property 30 years ago. You know, here's how the ownership changes, all the other stuff that we did to the property. The children may know parts of that, but it's amazing that often they're not up to speed, as knowledgeable as the parents might think they are. Sometimes they're not. We'll just flip it that way.
Yep, and they communicate maybe what they thought they heard, and that is a game of telephone over the years, too, and certainly, yeah, not prepared for what the reality of the situation is.
Puts me to mind to that interview that Tom Brokaw, thank you. Oh, darn. Radar. Tom Brokaw had with his daughter. And he said, and she knows, of course, that we have a living will. And he went on talking like that. And she looked at him when he was all through talking. And she said, Dad, I had no idea that you had a living will. So wasn't that interesting. So next, is the trustee aware of the potential personal liability as trustee to the trust beneficiaries for mistakes that could either accelerate taxes or cause losses for trust beneficiaries? So personal liability issues.
Yeah, absolutely. And just big overreaching, the fact that a trustee is in a fiduciary position to be acting in the best interest, obviously not of themselves, but of all the trust beneficiaries. And there are lots of decisions to be made that could affect those beneficiaries in different ways. And personal liability is a big one I always discuss with clients, where it comes up. Everybody's in a rush to make distributions and get stuff out, but we haven't finished creditor's claims period, or there's a creditor out there. And if they make an improper distribution, they can be the one. They're not going back to get the money from the beneficiaries. They're going to be personally liable to come up with that.
Here's another great question. By the way, how much time do we have here, Ron?
We have about 6 to 7 minutes.
Beautiful.
And we have one question on the text line.
Oh, too. Sure. Let's do that, shall we?
That is, what would like to know which is better or has more power, a guardianship or power of attorney?
That's a great question. And typically when we do powers of attorney and we think of a guardianship in a true sense of somebody who has power to make decisions over somebody's body, so separate than a conservatorship, which would be finances. And so guardianships are appropriate in certain circumstances if you have a very comprehensive healthcare power of attorney that can actually be used in place of a guardianship for certain circumstances as well. So we use healthcare powers of attorney comprehensive to actually, in most cases, avoid having to go get a guardianship over a person. That being said, there are certain circumstances when actually going through the process to become a legal guardian for somebody is what's most appropriate in that circumstance.
Okay. So sometimes you'll see an expansive use of that power to do other things, given individual situations that merit that.
Correct.
Correct. Does the trustee know how and when to get a trust tax ID number? Trust tax ID number. So what is that all about? Why would a trust need an ID number?
Yep, and that comes back to different types of trust. If we're generally speaking about the grantor revocable living trust, that is something where it's disregarded during your lifetime, and that is just your Social Security number, no special tax reporting. But upon death, then your Social Security number goes away, and at that point, we apply for a tax trust ID or a trust tax ID number, because then that trust becomes its own, tax reporting entity at that point in time.
I would include, does the trustee understand the tax rates within a trust and how egregiously high they are within the trust? The trust tax rates are exponentially higher than regular tax rates. Mm. So owning property within a trust that's throwing off income, and especially for some time, may subject the owners, the real owners, if you will, or the trustees of that trust, to significant taxes that they weren't aware of.
Yeah,
as they
people
inherit.
People don't realize how quickly from, again, trust is separate tax reporting entity, how quickly those brackets go up at very low income levels if that income is not distributed out of that trust.
Does the trustee know about the September 30th beneficiary designation date, the period from the date of the IRA owner's death to September 30th of the year following the year of the IRA owner's death, is known as the post-death gap or shakeout period? So can I ask you to expand on that?
Well, that again goes back to depending on the type of assets, and when we have pre-tax dollars that are either in the trust and are not being paid directly to beneficiaries, and even if they are paid directly to beneficiaries, do they know how to handle those? What are those deadlines that they are supposed to be abiding by, and what are the consequences as far as penalties or anything else if they don't do that?
Fantastic. Now, so does the trustee know to pay off debts and expenses during the shakeout period? Another great, in essence, running a small business, isn't it?
Yeah, and especially if we do have potentially a significant amount of debt or creditors, do we know how to handle those and what the laws say of how we can handle those, and making sure trustees, beneficiaries understand they are not personally liable for the debts of someone else's estate. Because as we know, creditors can be very persistent and, reminding them that that is not their obligation. They do not need to pay that, and we go through the process of satisfying that from the estate.
Is the trust responsible for the deceased person's debts?
Yes,
the trust.
Correct.
The
type of trust we're talking about. Absolutely. Yep.
So is that where they put something in the newspaper? Because what if you don't know there's a creditor out there? I mean, how do you know?
Yep. Then there's those laws. Again, what the responsibilities are of the trustee or the what we call our personal representative under our will, there is a notice to creditors. And that's that publication you see in the newspaper, which basically puts any unknown creditor out there on notice that they have 4 months to present a claim. If they don't, their claim is forever barred. If we have known creditors, meaning ones that we know about, we do have to send a separate notice because they have a time frame as well before we can bar them from collecting.
So today, in today's world, there's so many ways to communicate. So is it just a newspaper? Can you put it on the internet? I mean, I'm like, how would you know where you have to put this notice?
So we have this conversation a lot. The estate planning world, we are very antiquated still.
Okay.
On so many levels. So yes, that is a physical publication in the newspaper.
Excellent. Thank you.
Great. So to contact you again, Courtney, how should someone do that?
Sure. Phone number again, 231-714-0157.
Or DAR Law, DAR Law, correct?
Correct. Or DARLawyers.com.
Lawyers.com. Yep. Thank you. Plural. Thank you. Thank you.
And for Prout Financial Design, 947-3992, Google it or just remember ProutFinancialDesign.com.
Correct.
All right. We will wrap it up here today. Dennis Prout, Heidi Cartwright, special guest Courtney Danbrook.